Okay, so thank you very much for chatting to me this afternoon. And I'd like to start with how did you become part of Greenham?
Well, I'd heard about Greenham obviously like through the media at the time, but then it was when I was at Swansea. I was a student for a short while at Swansea University, and prior to that I'd been involved in CND, but then I was involved in the Women's Centre in Swansea, and so yeah, they were running kind of trips up to support the women who were there all the time from the uni. So that's how I got involved.
And what kind of support were they offering to the women?
So we'd go up, and if there was a blockade on, we'd go up to support that. And we'd also take, we'd do fundraising, and also we'd take food and, kind of run supplies in from a local town. What's it? Yeah, from the local town. I'm trying to think of what his name is now. God, it's so good. But yeah.
And how often did you visit Greenham?
Well, I went up with uni, and I think I did that twice, but then I went on my own after that a few times. But it was through those visits, that I kind of met people. I became politicized, basically. It really raised my kind of political consciousness, because there was all kinds of workshops. If there was a big blockade on, there was kind of workshops on, and women invited from all over the world. And so I kind of got to know, so I got involved in other causes. So one of the things that I really woke up to was, I mean, I hadn't realized what had been going on in those kind of atoll islands in the South Pacific, and all these kind of women who were having that kind of jelly babies because of the nuclear testing that the British Army had done there. And that was quite shocking, and I realized that how much news is kind of drip fed to people rather than it being anything that may be actually going on.
And so, how long were you associated with Greenham?
Oh, for a couple of years, and then I kind of met one of my oldest best friends through that, really, because she was involved in Greenham, so it was kind of a kind of shared cause, and she would go up very regularly with her daughter and her partner at the time. But it was kind of something which has kept us very much linked over the years, and also fed into me deciding to change tack a bit. And I left Swansea and went up to do women's studies up in Lancaster as a result.
So the experience there was a tremendous influence then on
Yeah.
your future life. Yes.
Yeah.
And so did you visit one camp or did you visit all of the camps whilst you were visiting?
No, I kind of used to hang around kind of Bluegate, but I mean, I used to, if it was a kind of, if we were ringing the base, I kind of would get involved in cutting through and getting onto the silos and stuff. But I mean, it was also the strength of the song which always stayed with me. We used to chant, and I still got an album, which Peggy Seeger did about the different songs, and it used to just wind the soldiers, like the military police, up, and also kind of a hostility from the local town was just tremendous. People, from the local town coming out and pouring buckets of shit over the women's tents and hurling abuse, and it was very, it wasn't glamorous.
So, was it what you had expected in it to
No. No, it was much rougher. It was much, much rougher. I think I'd expected before I went that it would be a bit more like kind of stuff from the 60s where I'd seen in film footage, where it was a bit more kind of festively. It was very, the women who stayed there all the time were incredibly dedicated, and it was rough conditions. You know, it's just English weather. It's not Californian weather.
And so were you surprised when women were imprisoned?
No, because I kind of realised what was going on then. It was just like, just seeing how, because it got me involved with other things like Clause 28 and later on and all kinds of things, but it just made me realise how corrupt the system was, really.
Mm-hmm. And how was the camp organised on a daily basis?
Well, from what I mean, in one way, it was kind of organised chaos. I mean, you know, we'd come in with supplies, for one thing. So, and of course, this was pre-mobile. So it was all done through kind of this telephone tree type of system, and then using your own common sense. So I don't know what it was like for people who live there full on all the time, but from what I could see, it was kind of like an understood kind of cooperation. And then, you know, you kind of did what you needed to do in your own little camp, you know, whether it's looking after someone's kids or, you know, helping if someone had been injured in something, or going, you know, kind of sharing food, cooking food, getting water and stuff. So, yeah, it was very grassroots.
And how many children were at the camp?
Well, there wasn't. There was people used to bring the children along. People weren't living. In my experience, I didn't see people like living up there. Well, you know, they were very little children. There was a few women like that, but you know, I suppose kids had to be at school. But people would bring their kids up, like my friend did. You know, on the week for a demonstration, for a blockade. So children were very much part of it, and also the reason why women were protesting. And also in later years, I'm half Libyan, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, when it was from there that missiles were fired, you know, to Tripoli and bombed, and kind of, you know, that's left a huge mark in the Libyan consciousness.
And so how did the children respond to being on the blockades and taking part? How did they feel about being at Greenham?
I think the children who I had contact with enjoyed it because everyone was involved, you know, and it wasn't like children were an add-on. It was also children were kind of looked after in a kind of that kind of village spirit, you know, that, you know, it takes a village to look after a child. And you know, and all the singing, it was very caring, you know, it was very caring. It wasn't an aggressive kind of thing. And obviously things like fires and chopping up woods and going to, you know, it's all very exciting for a kid. So I think I'd love, you know, it must be very interesting to hear the effect that had on those children and what they're doing now.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me about some of the blockades that you were involved with.
Well, I remember one where, you know, it was like, oh, get up here now, we're going to do this blockade. And we ringed the base, and there was all the different gates, you know, kind of involved. But the police kind of moved in and were dragging women off. But one of the women, I forget her name, but it was my friend's mate. I mean, she had a fit. She had a serious seizure during it all. And they just continued to drag her off and throw her in this van, you know, and cart her off to the police cells. So they were very, but it felt like you were part of something and we were trying to change something. I don't feel like that's ever since that time. You know, it was all, you know, and it was all linked with a miners strike, which I kind of was on the periphery of. I was from the northeast of England, so saw the pits all getting shut down. But in terms of the blockades, it was that kind of sense of just linking arms and singing a song. And then the other thing was cutting through the wire and going onto the bass, which did, and then Jeeps come in trying to catch you, but it was just showing like the ridiculous nature of war, really. And but it was incredible to see how song could create such aggression. You know, it used to just really wind these military police characters up.
So was it the same song that you sang all the time? Do you remember any of the words?
Yeah, well, I've got the album. I've got, you know, "We will rise, we will be strong, we will go on and on like a mountain." You know, it was all those ones. And I mean, I've got the album. I've got an LP which I found in the charity shop with them all on, and I know them all when I see, you know, like when I see them all, and I just think it's. I just remember that one particularly, that we'll rise on, go on and on, like, you know, kind of a mountain, like a river. And just very natural, easy chants, but just incredible to see the effect of a piece of, like, you know, kind of promoting peace and kind of cooperation.
And so you mentioned that some of the residents, some of the locals, were not very receptive to you being there. So were there any who did welcome you and help you and support you?
Well, they tended to be women. It's the locals who tended to be hostile were men. So I think they saw it as a direct threat in some way. And I think they used to go to the pub on a Saturday night and get drunk and then decide, you know, wind each other up and then come out. You know, this is in the days really before drink driving. You know, it was just people drop up and just, you know, after pub closing time. But it was local women, I think. But I think some of those were doing it kind of undercover a bit from their partners. They were supportive, but they didn't want that to be known particularly in the local town. Because I think it was, you know, it was quite a divisive kind of subject, I think. You know, because it got a lot of media attention.
Mm. So how well do you think the media represented you?
I think it was absolutely ridiculous the way the media. I mean, that's another reason I got politicised and went up to Lancaster, because the Glasgow media group showed how all these things were being. I mean, it just showed it just made out all the women were kind of banshees who were just kind of out of control, all lesbians and kind of, you know, out to kind of destroy the fabric of Tory Thatcherite Britain. And it, you know, and it wasn't like that. It was Quakers, it was married women who were married and, you know, decided to go and protest and stuff. You know, there was lots also of discussion around sexuality and stuff, but that wasn't why people that were there. And it certainly, I mean, like I said, it wasn't glamorous. For me, it was a place where serious questions were getting raised.
Mm-hmm. And so how were you treated by the police and the soldiers?
Oh, they just thought a bunch of lunatics, basically. And a nuisance, you know, and rather we'd have all just gone back to so-called our husbands and all, you know, kind of just disappeared, really. I mean, there was police brutality, which I witnessed, but overall, you know, it was kind of like a kind of very dismissive attitude of like, haven't you got anything better to do? Rather than thinking about what was really going on.
Mm. And so what was the brutality that you witnessed?
Well, like I said, I saw women being dragged off when they were unwell, when they were having fits, being kicked when they're on the ground, being spat at, hair being pulled, you know, kind of called really abusive language, derogatory language around kind of size and sexuality and stuff. So
We talked earlier about the children that were at the camp, and I just wondered, how well do you think the legacy of Greenham has been relayed to today's generation of children?
Well, I don't think a lot of people know about it. It's kind of was almost like vaped from kind of memory. I was working in a team with younger women, and someone said, "Well, what's Greenham?" And I had to kind of educate her on what it was. And she was quite, you know, she was an intelligent young woman, but she hadn't heard anything about it. She didn't know anything about it. She'd heard about the miners' strikes, but she didn't know about Greenham.
What do you think needs to be done in order to bring that legacy forward?
Well, I think a really decent documentary, and it being serious documentary, not just kind of some kind of flippant, like kind of nostalgia thing, and also it being involved, you know, it's part of social history, and also for young people to realise that protest is important, you know. And I think a lot of young people now, so you know, they're so kind of duped by the system, by exams and social media pressures that they've all got, you know. It's like that choice to actually pause and think about things and actually go, well, actually, am I agreeing with this? And realizing that there's a tradition of dissent, and I think that's very important.
Yes. Why do you think it is that the suffrage movement has been celebrated, whereas the peace movement hasn't?
Well, I think that was because the suffrage movement is more bound up with class. With, you know, there was upper class women involved in it who were good at networking, and you know, had influence, power, and influence and money. Whereas I think Greenham, you know, there was a lot of women there who didn't have a lot, very much money at all. You know, it was more like to grassroots, and it certainly wasn't glamorous. And also, it was for a more general, you know, it was like making a point about, you know, American missiles being on British soil, about nuclear disarmament, rather than with the vote. It was about a distinct one thing, and which affected at that time especially wealthy women more than working class women. So you know, I think again, it's who's got the power and who's writing history.
So if you were writing the history of Greenham, what would you write about what the Greenham women achieved?
I think it was important. I think it's a really good question, and which I'd need probably more time to answer. But I think one of the things which was achieved was showing that women can organise together collectively, and that the kind of state as a unity can be challenged, and it can be challenged by groups of people who are, you know, who don't wield power in a very, you know, it was a very, for just a bunch of women to go and walk to that base and then camp, and then the amount of meat, I mean, it was on the 6 o'clock news, loads with kind of a hysteria around it, about like as if there was witches kind of about to kind of take over. And so I think what was important was the power of the collective in this grassroots way, and about also for me, it changed me in that it also in how it was workshops organized there. I hadn't really been involved in workshopping, and everything was done really, really cheaply through donations and everyone just banding together, but a lot of information shared on what was really going on. And I think it was phenomenal, actually. And I haven't really witnessed that ever again in the same way, the potency of what happened.
And how were the workshops organised?
Well, basically, you had to get a group of women together, and then someone's offered, say, I'd like to offer this workshop. Can I? You know, and then it would be as simple as that. And then they'd run a workshop, you know. I mean, whereas nowadays, all these things have got commodified and bureaucratized.
How long would workshops last for?
Well, I remember like the one I went to on the Marshall Islands, and that was about 50 minutes, but it there'd be a speaker, and then there'd be just dialogue. It would be more about, you'd get talking to people as well and arguing. I think that was the other thing. It was the way that it was dialogue was encouraged, but not in this kind of lecturing way. You know, it was kind of encouraging people to find their voice, but also it would take a long time to get to decisions on other things, because things were collaborative, and to work in a cooperative, it takes much longer than a kind of, you know, pyramid structure. And I think that's kind of been a bit lost as well along the way.
And so what do you think today's peacemakers and activists and protesters could learn from the Greenham Common women about how to protest?
I think there's something about an egalitarianism of keeping things simple, of allowing people, of giving people, of encouraging each other to speak, to offer your own experience and knowledge, and about sharing resources. People would share resources, they'd share food, they'd share money, they'd share lifts, you know, clothes, a chair. It was very much so, and there was great power in doing that, and also just the grassroots thing of sitting down and the power of voice and singing.
So have you kept in contact with many women from Greenham?
Well, I've got a really good friend in Australia who kind of was involved on the fringes of it, but like, she's one of my old, well, she's my oldest female friend. She was very involved in Greenham, and it's been a shared bond which has kept us together through the years, really. And you know, I've continued to, you know, I just respect her, and it's such a shared thing. And to realize that, you know, at the time you didn't think, well, this will never really happen again.
Mm-hmm. And so, is there a moment or an emotion or a picture that sums up Greenham for you?
Well, for me, it's woolly jumpers and arms linked around the bases and singing, and the police just been the kind of exasperation on their faces, because there was great joy, you know, as well. It wasn't miserable as well, you know. It was, when we were singing, it was very joyful.
So that's your memory, and the woolly sweaters to keep you warm. So were they knitted at the camp?
Some people knitted them at the camp, otherwise they were like from jumble size and stuff. But yeah, woolly jumpers, you know, because old woolly jumpers and woolly hats. And also the other thing was cutting through and dancing on one of the silos, and the military jeep coming and chasing us.
So were you actually holding wire cutters and using wire cutters? Were you? Oh, tell me a little more about that, Sarah.
Well, someone had got hold of some bolt cutters, so we just cut through on the side of the base and then went through. And we were also, other women were tying ribbons and things like that to the wire. But we just went through, and then we were running around and got on top of one of the silos. Of course, the military police jeep turns up and chases us around. But it was just to show how ridiculous the security, you know, this is place with top level weapons and you know, a bunch of women can just kind of cut through.
Were you standing on each other's shoulders as well when you were doing that?
Yeah, people were, if I remember, and there was all, I mean, it was, again, it was all that one woman would find some way in and then you'd all just barrel through. But it was all very ad hoc, you know.
And so were you involved in any of the other demonstrations where, I think it was at Easter, with all the Easter rabbits, knitted Easter rabbits going on?
No, but my friend was. She knitted loads of those. I mean, there was just, oh, and there was always something going on. And I think, you know, I think it was an amazing cauldron of experience, because there was women who were very young. I was one, you know, I was a youngster there. There was women who were in their 70s and 80s there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge, huge kind of spectrum of experience, and women with kids, women who had disabilities, you know, who were on walking sticks, and, you know, and also the other thing was that, you know, it was whole already kind of conscious raising around class and around race, which was comparatively new, really, for those questions to be asked.
Yes. And were there women from other countries as well?
Yes.
So did you mention Australia and...
Yeah, there was women from the Marshall Islands who came. There was Indian women. There was women from Germany, you know, there was some women from France turned up. It was international.
Yes. And so what made you decide not to continue visiting the camp, and how long was that before it actually all faded away as it did?
I think it was just coming to the end anyway, and I kind of went up to Lancaster, so I just kind of, it just kind of, it was circumstantial, really. When I'd been at Swansea, it had been quite comparatively easy to get there in some ways, because it's just along the M4 at Newbury, but in Lancaster, it was a lot further away, but it was part of how I got into Lancaster, because Sylvia Wolby was a professor there, and I hitched up to my interview, and she asked me stuff, and it was definitely, you know, I talked about Greenham, and that was definitely one of the reasons she offered me a place, I'm sure of it.
Yes. And what did your family think about you going to Greenham?
Well, there was only my adoptive father around at the time, and he just thought it was a bunch of lunatics, and he just thought I was having some kind of phase. Even though he was actually a communist himself, but he thought it was just he kind of saw what was on the news, which made it just look like it was some kind of hippie camp or something.
Yes. Did he change his mind?
Not really, only because he got involved in other things. His wife died, so I think, you know, it wasn't topmost of his priorities.
Yes. And so what were your thoughts after you left Greenham?
Well, it raised my consciousness, because that's, you know, when I did units at Lancaster on the Women's Studies degree, which were directly related to workshops that I'd done at Greenham. And I stayed friends, like I said, really good friends with one woman in particular. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, that experience. We often talk about Greenham to this day. So, yeah.
Yes, and what kind of things do you remember together?
Well, yeah, about mud.
The mud.
The cold. Yeah. But also the singing, and also just that kind of the camaraderie and the kind of spirit, which I feel it's a shame that young women haven't had that experience in their generation subsequently.
And so are there any questions that you would have liked me to ask, which I haven't?
No, not really. I mean, yeah, I think for me personally, you know, it took on even a different level when I found out later that, because at the time I didn't realise I was adopted. I didn't realise I was Libyan. So it was only afterwards, years later, I realised I'd been protesting about missiles which were being fired at my own family's town.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How did you feel about that, Sarah?
Well, just proud that I had, you know, something had driven me to do that.
Yes, yes. And how did you find out? How did you find out all that information?
Finding out about, you know, kind of the history of Libya and why Gaddafi, you know, because Gaddafi's own adoptive daughter had been killed in a bombing. So that's, you know, why he also had certain views on the West and stuff. But it just, you know, to this day, I just think it's complete, you know, waste of people's resources having nuclear weapons. I haven't changed my views. I remember a teacher at school going, oh, when you get older, you become more right-wing. That's just natural progression. And I thought, I won't. And she said, well, you will, everyone does, but I haven't.
Mm. Mm. And so, in summary then, what would be your five words to describe Greenham and your experience at Greenham?
Well, transformative would be definitely one of them. Passionate would be another. Grassroots and solidarity and consciousness raising.
Very powerful words.
Yeah.
So it really was a transformational process for you personally.
Yeah.
As well as for the country. Mm. Is there any other thing that's floated into your thoughts as we've kind of talked?
Well, and just again, the power of song. The power of song and the power and how... If you're really passionate about something, you don't need mobiles, not stuff. You can organise yourself and with very little resources. So there's something about, you know, it's definitely song, because if we'd just all been around the base, I think it wouldn't have had the potency if we hadn't been singing.
Yes.
As in the minute I've got the lyrics, I know that it's just it's like a mantra song. But it's beautiful.
Yes. And we will go on and on.
On and on. Yeah.
And maybe that's a good point to end this, is it? With yeah. That message. The green will go on and on and on. Well, it's been lovely to talk with you and share your experiences and the way in which you transformed your life. Amazing.
So, well, thank you for your time, Tricia.
My pleasure. Great pleasure. I've spoken to lots of Greenham women and I am always so impressed, and I come back impressed and inspired, and I come back feeling very humble about it. Yeah.